rose to battle with my attackers. Toot soared in from directly overhead, his heels landing hard on my stomach. For somebody the size of a chicken, he was strong, and my breath huffed out as I was knocked back to the ground. He planted his feet wide, a snarl on his tiny face, his shield hefted up to a defensive position, his table knife sword in hand.
Stay down, my lord! Wait until we clear a path for escape!
A path? I took a second to look around. I saw one of Toot's colonels go by, flying sideways, wielding a spear made of a straight pen and a pencil against another of the little folk. A tiny humanish figure dressed in what looked like actual black armor made of some kind of shaped plastic, or maybe carapace, and carrying another of the two familiar nails. The enemy fairy was wounded, and glowing motes of scarlet and sullen orange light dribbled from a straight pin-inflicted wound on his tiny leg. Sullen and chill spheres of light darted everywhere, dozens of them, all spinning and diving and looping at once. There was no way to track all of that motion. Even if I'd been completely clear-headed, I would have done well to follow a tenth of it. Five or six more enemy fey, larger and brighter than the others, dived down at me bearing a nail sword in each hand. They let out shrill, eerie little cries as they came at me and at Toot Toot. Okay, I've thought a lot of things about Toot Toot over the years. I've compared him to a lot of really humorous stuff, and occasionally to people I didn't admire too much. I've made jokes at his expense, though never when I thought it would hurt him. But if you'd asked me for a perfect parallel for the little guy a year ago, I would never, ever, ever have said King Leonidas. Toot let out a high-pitched roar and leapt into the air. He smashed his shield into the black armored fey in the center of the enemy formation, spinning as he did to send the luckless fairy careening into the companion on his left. Toot's sword lashed out as he did, and a single dragonfly wing went fluttering free of the body it had been attached to. The little fey went spinning out of the air to crash into a pile of fallen bricks and rubble. Two got through. Agony. The next thing I knew, Toot was pulling a nail from the muscle over my abdomen, and fresh hits there and in my left pectoral muscle had added their toll of pain to my evening. Toot, gripping the nail carefully by its duct tape handle, turned and flung it at a pair of dueling fey, striking the orange-lit enemy with the broadside of the steel nail. There was a flash of white light, and the hit fey let out a shriek that started at the edge of human hearing and went up into dog frequencies and darted away, the guard in hot pursuit.
"They're breaking!"
Toot bellowed. Well, as much as someone who could fit into a bread box can bellow.
"After them, colonels!"
Sullen lights slithered away in panic, while bright balls of blue buzzed after them.
"Permission to pursue those jerks, my lord!"
Toot shouted. I finally had a couple of seconds to get my head together. I shook it violently. It didn't help, but the simple act of putting together recognition of a problem, consideration of a solution, and taking action to fix it had gotten my mental house in some kind of order. "It's a feint," I said, looking around. "They're luring the guard away." There, high up, way the hell high up, maybe 20 stories, a blob of burnt ember light suddenly plunged off of a balcony and began to fall toward us. As it came closer, the blob broke apart into dozens of angry little spheres. They began to bob and interweave, picking up more and more speed, the patterns dizzying, confusing. Streaking lights peeled off from the main cloud in every direction. Toot, once more perched on my stomach, stared up at them, his mouth open, his left arm sagged, his shield dropping down to his side.
"Uh-oh,"
he gulped.
I'm not sure I can get them all, my lord."
I sat up, forcing him off my stomach and gained my feet. "You did good, Toot," I growled. "Okay, small fry. Wizard time." A couple of years back, me and my apprentice Molly had been studying air magic as part of her basic grounding in the elemental forces. She hadn't ever picked up the knack for using blasts of wind as weapons, but she had managed to develop a spell that did a passable imitation of a blow dryer. I lifted my right hand, summoned my will, and readied the blow-dryer spell. Only I turned it to 11.
Ventas reductus!
I thundered, unleashing my will, and an arctic gale came howling and shrieking from my outstretched hand. It condensed the damp October air into mist, too, bellowing out from my hand in a cone the size of an apartment building. Frost formed on every surface in the immediate area. It struck the cloud of diving little folk and sent them tumbling in every direction. Little orange lights went spinning and wobbling, their complex formation shattered. I saw them begin to gather to one side, trying to reform. But I poured on the wind and altered the direction of the blast, scattering them again. Molly's spell was more efficient than anything I'd come up with when I had her level of experience, but there's no free lunch. That much wind takes a lot of energy to whip up, and I wasn't going to be able to hold it forever. Abruptly, Toot flashed away from me, diving through the air, his wings a blur. He vanished behind the nose of a parked car on the other side of the street, brandishing his sword. A brawl spilled out from the tail end of the car an instant later. One of the enemy little folk went tumbling in a windmill of arms and legs and fetched up against the corpse of the traffic signal. Two went darting away in obvious panic, their flight erratic and swift, dropping their nail swords as they fled. And then there was a flash of sparks as steel struck steel, and Toot came out from behind the truck, frantically defending himself from another of the little folk, almost as tall as he was. The foe was dressed in black armor, covered in spikes made from the tips of freaking fish hooks, even the helmet, and he fought with what seemed to be an actual sword designed to size. A wavy bladed thing that I think was called a flamberge. As I watched, the enemy champion's blade sheared half an inch of aluminum from the top of Toot's shield, and he followed up with a series of heavy, two-handed blows meant to divide Toot in half. Toot bobbed and weaved like a reed, but the assault was ferocious, the foe as fast as he was. He got the flat of the shield in front of another blow, stopping it, but on the next strike, the flamberge's wavy blade caught on the edge of the shield and sliced through it again, leaving it little more than a rectangle of aluminum strapped to Toot's arm. Toot took to the air, but his opponent matched him, and they darted and spun around a light pole, the enemy's sword meeting Toot's improvised blade in flashes of silver sparks. I wanted to intervene, but, like it always does, size mattered. My target was tiny and moving fast. The pair of them were darting around so much that even if I got lucky and hit someone, I probably had as much chance of taking out Toot as I did Captain Hook over there. My evocation magic was more focused and precise than it had ever been, thanks to Mab, but my control still wasn't up to the task of being that discriminating. And besides, I still had to keep my giant leaf blower going against the rest of Hook's goons. All I could do was watch. Hook swung at Toot's head, but Toot ducked in the nick of time, and the flamberge caught briefly in the metal of the streetlight's post.
"Aha!"
Toot said, and slammed his table knife down onto Hook's armored hand. The other fey recoiled, obviously in pain, and the flamberge fell to the ground.
"Surrender, villain!" Toot cried. "Face the justice of the Tsar Lord!"
"Never!"
answered another piping voice from within the helmet, and Hook produced a pair of toothpick-slender daggers. He made a scissor shape of them and caught Toot's next attack in it, flicking the table knife aside and whipping his dagger at Toot's throat. Toot recoiled, but took a long cut across his chest, the knife shearing through his armor, just as the flamberge had done. My major general screamed in pain, recoiling. It was the opening I needed, and I twisted my leaf blower around a slam into Hook. It caught the little fey as he was starting to move toward Toot Toot, sending him tumbling into the side of a building, while the backblast of wind actually threw Toot clear. He managed to recover in midair, wings blurring, and shot unsteadily toward me. I caught him in my free hand, drawing him in close against my side, and turned partly away from Hook, sheltering Toot. The cloud of hostile fey was swirling and wobbling around. They obviously lacked any kind of leadership, and were still disordered by the gale-force winds with which I'd hit them. but I was almost out of energy. And about 2 seconds after they got their act together, I was a dead man. "Feats don't fail me now," I muttered. I kept the leaf blower on Hook, who I suspected was their leader, and strode forward toward the car. I checked it with several quick glances. The gasoline smell wasn't coming from the caddy, but from a half-smashed car that had been close to the exploding duffel bag. I gave the leaf blower one last surge of power and lunged into the car, slamming the door behind me. I dumped Toot down next to Bob, as gently as I could.
"What's happening?"
Bob shouted blearily from where he'd landed, sideways, in the well of the passenger seat.
"I'm getting my ass kicked by tiny fairies!"
I shouted back, fumbling to start the car.
"They've got my freaking number!"
There was a loud pop, and a slender, miniature steel dagger slammed through the passenger window, transforming it into a broken webwork, as difficult to see through as a stained glass window.
"Ack!"
I said. Bob started laughing hysterically. The dagger vanished, and then the same thing happened on the driver's side. Holy crap. Hook was way too bright for someone the size of a Tickle Me Elmo. He was blinding me. I got the caddy into reverse and rumbled back off the sidewalk onto the street, shedding bricks and debris as I went. Just as I bounced down onto the street proper, the front windshield exploded into a web of cracks, too, so I just kept driving backward, turning to look over my shoulder. That went well for a few seconds, and then the rear window broke, too. I gritted my teeth. Under normal circumstances, the next move would be to roll down the window and stick my head out of it. Tonight, I was pretty sure I'd get a tiny dagger in the eye if I tried. Sometimes you have to choose between doing something stupid and doing something suicidal. So I kept driving blind and backward through the middle of Chicago while Bob chortled his bony ass off.
"Tiny fairies,"
he giggled, rolling a bit as the caddy weaved and jounced.
"Tiny fairies."
My plan worked for about 10 seconds, and then I slammed into a parked car. I was lucky that it wasn't a large one. I mean, I couldn't see it, but it bounced off the caddy like a billiard ball struck by the cue ball. It also knocked the wheel out of my hands, wrenching it from my fingers and sending the caddy onto another sidewalk. It smashed through a metal railing, and then the back tires bounced down into a sunken stairwell. I struggled to get the caddy clear, but there was nothing for the tires to grab onto. End of the line. I let out a heartfelt curse and slammed a fist against the steering wheel. Then I made myself close my eyes and think.
"Think, think. Don't react in panic. Keep your head, Dresden."
"Major General," I said, "you okay?"
"It's not bad, my lord,"
he gasped.
"I've had worse."
"We've got to move," I said.
"Run away,"
Bob giggled.
"Run away, tiny fairies."
I growled in frustration and popped the Red Cap's hat down over Bob.
"Stop being a jerk. This is serious."
Bob's voice was only barely muffled. It sounded like he couldn't breathe.
"Serious, tiny fairies? The mighty wizard Dresden."
"You're not as funny as you think you are," I said severely. "Toot, you got any ideas?"
"Trap them all in a circle?"
Toot suggested. I sighed.
"Right. I just need to get them all to land in the same place at the same time, inside of a magic circle I had no means to create. Toot's a great little guy, just not really advisor material."
Orange light began to bathe the broken windows, highlighting the webwork of cracks in them. A lot of orange light.
"Crap," I gasped. "I am not going to be known as the wizard who used his death curse thanks to a bunch of bitty nail guns."
Then there was a very sinister sound. Toward the rear of the caddy, someone opened the lid to the fuel tank. It wasn't hard to work out what would happen next. Fire.
"Hell no," I said.
I recovered the cap, turned a still giggling Bob upside down, and then popped Toot into the skull. He sprawled in it, arms and legs sticking out, but he didn't complain.
"Hey," Bob protested. "Serves you right, Giggles," I snapped.
I tucked the skull under my arm like a football. I knew I didn't have much of a chance of getting away from that swarm of fey piranha, but it was an infinitely larger chance than I would have if I stayed in the car and burned to death. Hell's bells, what I wouldn't give to have my shield bracelet.
or my old staff. I didn't even have an umbrella. I wasn't sure how much more magic I had left in me, but I readied my shield spell, shaping it to surround me as I ran. I wouldn't be able to hold it in place for long, but maybe if I got very, very lucky, I would survive the swarm long enough to find another option. I took several sharp and completely not panicked breaths, then piled out of the Cadillac, bringing my shield up with a shout of,
"Defendarius!"
The little folk started hitting my shield almost instantly. I once rode out a hailstorm in a dome-shaped Quonset hut made of corrugated steel. It sounded like that, only closer, and a hell of a lot more lethal. I went into a sprint. Between the still-present dust, the shroud of mist my leaf-blower spell had billowed forth, and the swarm of hostile fae I could barely see. I picked a direction and ran, 10 steps, 20 steps. The enemy continued pounding against the shield, and as I kept pouring my will into it to keep it in place, my body began to feel heavier and heavier. 30 steps, and I stepped into a small pothole in the sidewalk, stumbled, and fell. Falling in a fight is generally bad. You tend not to get up again. I mean, there's a reason that the phrase, "he fell," was synonymous with death for a bunch of centuries. I fell. And then I heard the most beautiful sound of my life. Somewhere nearby, a cat let out an angry, hissing scream. The little folk live in mortal dread of Felis Domesticus. Cats are observant, curious, and fast enough to catch the little fae. Hell, the domestic cat can stalk, kill, and subsist upon more species than any other land predator in the world. They are peerless hunters, and the little folk know it. The effect of the scream was instantaneous. My attackers recoiled on pure reflex, immediately darting about 20 feet into the air, even hook. I got a chance to look up and saw a large, brindle tomcat leap from the top of a trash can onto the sidewalk beside me.
"No!"
shouted Hook from inside his helmet.
"Slay the beast! Slay them all!"
"What? What did I ever do to you?" Bob protested, indignant. "I'm not even supposed to be here today."
The fae all looked at Hook and seemed to begin gathering their courage again. A second cat screamed nearby, and a third, and a fourth. Cats started prowling out of alleys and from beneath parked cars. Cats began pacing along building ledges 20 feet from the ground. Glowing eyes reflected light from the deep shadows between buildings. Even Hook wasn't willing to put up with that action, I guess. The little fae champion let out a frustrated scream, then turned and darted up, up and away, vanishing into the night. The others followed Hook, flowing away in a ribbon of amber light. I lay there for a second, exhausted and panting, then I sat up and looked around. The cats were gone, vanished as if they'd never been there. I heard someone walk out of the alley behind me, and my body went tense and tight despite my weariness. Then a young woman's voice said, in a passable British accent, "The little folk are easily startled, but they'll soon be back, and in greater numbers." I sagged in sudden, exhausted relief. The bad guys hardly ever quote Star Wars. "Molly," I breathed. A tall, young woman dressed in rather shabby second-hand clothing crouched down next to me and smiled. "Hey, boss. Welcome home." Chapter 13. "Grasshopper," I said, feeling myself smile. "Illusion. Very nice." Molly gave a little bow of her head.
"It's what I do."
"Also good timing," I said. "Also, what the hell? How did you know I was...
alive?"
"Here, but sure. How did you know?"
"Priorities, boss. Can you walk?"
"I'm good," I said, and pushed myself to my feet. It wasn't as hard as it really should have been, and I could feel my endurance rebuilding itself already, the energy coming back into me. I was still tired, don't get me wrong, but I should have been falling down dizzy, and I wasn't.
"You don't look so good," Molly said. "Was that a tux?"
"Briefly," I said. I eyed the car. "Feel like driving?"
"Sure," she said, "but that's pretty stuck, Harry. Unless you brought a crane."
I grunted, faintly irritated by her tone.
Just get in, start it, and give it gas, gently. Molly looked like she wanted to argue, but then she looked down abruptly. A second later, I heard sirens. She frowned, shook her head, and got into the car. The motor rumbled to life a second later. I went down the stairwell where the car's tires were stuck, set down Bob's skull, and found a good spot beneath the rear frame. Then I set my feet, put the heels of my hands against the underside of the caddy, and pushed. It was hard. I mean, it was really, really gut-bustingly hard, but the caddy groaned and then shifted and then slowly rose. I was lifting with my legs as much as my arms, putting my whole body into it, and everything in me gave off a dull burn of effort. My breath escaped my lungs in a slow groan, but then the tires were up out of the stairwell and turning, and they caught on the sidewalk, and the caddy pulled itself the rest of the way. I grabbed the skull, still with the mostly limp toot-toot inside it, staggered back up out of the stairwell and into the passenger side of the car. I lifted my hand and sent a surge of will down through it, muttering, "Forzare!" And the overstrained windshield groaned and gave way, tearing itself free of the frame and clearing Molly's vision. "Go," I panted. Molly went, driving carefully. The emergency vehicles were rolling in past us, and she pulled over and drove slowly to let them by. I sat there breathing hard, and realized that the real effort of moving that much weight didn't hit you while you were actually moving it. It came in the moments after, when your muscles recovered enough to demand oxygen right the hell now. I leaned my head against the window, panting. "How's it going, buddy?" I asked a moment later.
"It hurts," Toot sighed. "But I'll be okay, my lord. The armor held off some of the blow."
I checked the skull. The eyelights were gone. Bob had dummied up the moment Molly was around, as per my standing orders, which had been in place since she had first become my apprentice. Bob had almost unlimited knowledge of magic. Molly had a calculated disregard for self-limitation when she thought it justified. They would have made a really scary pair, and I kept them carefully separate during her training.
"We need to get off the street," I said, "someplace quiet and secure."
"I know a place just like that," Molly said. "What happened?"
"Someone tossed a gym bag full of explosives at my car," I growled, "and followed it up with the freaking Pixie Death Squadron from hell."
"You mean they picked this car out of all the other traffic?" she asked, her tone dry. "What are the odds?" I grunted.
"One more reason to get off the street, pronto."
"Relax," she said. "I started veiling the car as soon as we passed the police. If someone was following you before, they aren't now. Catch your breath, Harry. We'll be there soon."
I blinked, impressed. Veils were not simple spells. Granted, they were sort of a specialty of Molly's, but this was taking it up a notch. I didn't know whether I could have covered the entire caddy with a veil while driving alertly and carrying on a conversation. In fact, I was pretty sure I couldn't. Grasshopper was growing up on me.
I studied Molly's profile while she drove. Stared, really. I first met her years ago when she was a gawky little kid in a training bra. She'd grown up tall, 5'10" or a little more. She had dark blonde hair, although she had changed its color about 50 times since I'd met her. At the moment, it was in its natural shade and cut short, hanging in an even sheet to her chin. She was wearing minimal makeup. The girl was built like a particularly well-proportioned statue, but she wasn't flaunting it in this outfit. Khaki pants, a cream-colored shirt, and a chocolate-brown jacket. The last time I'd seen Molly, she'd been a starved-looking thing, dressed in rags and twitching at every sound and motion, like a feral cat. Which was hardly surprising, given that she'd been fighting a covert war against a group called the Fomor while dodging the cops and the wardens of the White Council. She was still lean and a little overly alert, her eyes trying to watch the whole world at once, but that sense of overly coiled spring tension was much reduced. She looked good. Noticing that made things stir under the surface. Things that shouldn't have been, and I abruptly looked away. She said, "Harry?"
"You look better than the last time I saw you, kiddo," I said.
She grinned briefly. Right back at you.
I snorted. It'd be hard to look worse for either of us, I guess. She glanced at me.
Yeah, I'm a lot better. I'm still not...
She shrugged.
I'm not exactly Little Miss Stability, at least not yet. But I'm working on it.
Sometimes I think that's where most of us are, I said. Fighting off the crazy as best we can, trying to become something better than we were. It's that second bit that's important.
She smiled and didn't say anything else. Within a few moments, she had turned the caddy into a private parking lot. I don't have any money for parking, I said.
Don't need it. She paused and rolled down the cracked window to wave at an attendant operating the gate. He glanced up from his book, smiled at her, and pushed a button. The gate opened, and Molly pulled the caddy into the lot. She drove down the length of it and pulled the car carefully into a covered parking spot.
Okay, come on.
We got out of the car, and Molly led me to a doorway, leading into an adjacent apartment building. She opened the door with a key, but instead of moving to the elevators, she guided me to another doorway to one side of the entrance. She unlocked that one, too, and went down two flights of stairs to a final door. I could sense magical defenses on the doors and the stairs without even making an effort to open myself up to it. That was a serious bunch of security spells. Molly opened the second door and said,
"Please come in."
She smiled at Toot.
"And your crew, with you, of course."
"Thanks," I said and followed her inside. Molly had an apartment. She had an apartment big enough for Hugh Hefner's birthday party. The living room was the size of a basketball court, and it had 11-foot ceilings. There was a little bar separating the kitchen from the rest of the open space. She had a fireplace with what looked like a handmade living room set around it in one corner of the room, and a second section of comfy chairs and a desk tucked into a nook lined with built-in bookshelves. She had a weight bench, too, along with an elliptical machine, both of them expensive European setups. The floors were hardwood, broken up by occasional carpets that probably cost more than the total cost of the floor space they covered. A couple of doors led off from the main room. They were oak, granite countertops, a 6-burner gas stove, recessed lighting.
"Hell's bells," I said.
Nice place." Molly shrugged out of her jacket and tossed it onto the back of a couch.
"You like?"
She walked into the kitchen, opened a cabinet door, and pulled out a first aid kit.
"I like," I said.
How?
"The Svartalfs built it for me," she said.
Svartalfs? They were some serious customers in the supernatural scene. Peerless artisans. A very private and independent folk. And they tolerated absolutely no nonsense. No one wants to get on the bad side of a Svartalf. They weren't exactly known for their generosity, either.
"You working for them?" I asked.
"No," she said. "This is mine. I bought it from them." I blinked again.
"With what?"
"Honor," she said. She muttered something and flicked a hand at a chandelier hanging over the table in a little dining area. It began to glow with a pure white light as bright as any collection of incandescent bulbs.
"Bring him over here and we'll see if we can't help him."
I did so, transferring Toot from the skull to the table as gently as possible. Molly leaned down over him, peering.
"Right through the breastplate? What hit you, Toot Toot?"
"A big, fat jerk," Toot replied, wincing. "He had a real sword, too. You know how hard it is to convince any of you big people to make us a sword we can actually use?"
"I saw his gear," I said. "I totally liked yours better, Major General. Way cooler and more stylish than that stupid Black Knight look." Toot gave me a brief, fierce grin.
"Thank you, my lord."
Toot got out of his ruined armor with effort, and with Molly's cautious, steady-fingered help, I managed to clean the wound and bandage it. It looked ugly, and Toot was anything but happy during the process, but he was clearly uncomfortable and weary, rather than being badly hurt. Once the wound was taken care of, Toot promptly flopped onto the table and went to sleep. Molly smiled, got a clean towel out of a cabinet, and draped it over the little guy.
Toot seized it and curled up beneath it with a sigh. All right, Molly said, picking up the first aid kit. She beckoned me to follow her to the kitchen. Your turn, off with a shirt.
Not until you buy me dinner, I said.
For a second she froze, and I wondered whether that had come out like the joke it had sounded like in my mind. Then she recovered. Molly arched her eyebrow in a look that was disturbingly like that of her mother. A woman around with whom a wise man will not mess, and folded her arms. Fine, I said, rolling my eyes. I shrugged my way out of the ruined tux.
Jesus, Molly said softly, looking at me. She leaned around me, frowning at my back. You look like a passion play.
Doesn't feel so bad, I said.
It might if one of these cuts gets infected, Molly said. Just stand there and hold still. Man.
She went to the cabinet and came back with a big brown bottle of hydrogen peroxide and a couple of kitchen towels. I watched her walking back and forth.
We'll start with your back. Lean on the counter.
I did, resting my elbows on the granite, still watching her. Molly fumbled with the supplies for a second, then bit her lower lip and began to move with purpose. She started dribbling peroxide onto the cuts on my back in little bursts of cold liquid that might have made me jump before I'd spent so much time in Arctis Tor. It burned a little, and then fizzed enthusiastically.
So, not one question? I asked her.
Hmm? She didn't look up from her work. I come back from the dead. I sort of expected, I don't know, a little shock, and about a million questions.
I knew you were alive, Molly said.
Yeah, I sort of figured. How? She didn't answer, and after a moment I realized the likely answer.
My godmother. She takes her Yoda-ing seriously.
I remember, I said, keeping my tone neutral. How long have you known?
Several weeks, Molly said. There are so many cuts here. I don't think I have enough band-aids. We'll have to wrap it, I guess.
I'll just put a clean shirt over them, I said. Look, it isn't a big deal. Little marks like that are going to be gone in a day or two.
Little winter night stuff?
Pretty much, I said. Mab kind of gave me the tour during my recovery.
What happened? She asked.
I found my eyes wandering to Bob's skull. Telling Molly what was going on would mean that she was involved. It would draw her into the conflict. I didn't want to expose her to that kind of danger. Not again. Of course, it probably wasn't my sole decision. And besides, Molly had intervened in an assassination that had been really close to succeeding. Whoever was behind the swarm of piranha pixies had probably seen it. Molly was already in the fight. If I started keeping things from her now, it would only hinder her chances of surviving it. I didn't want her to get involved, but she'd earned the right to make that choice for herself. So I gave it to her, straight, succinct, and with zero editing, except for the bit about Halloween. It felt sort of strange. I hardly ever tell anyone that much truth. The truth is dangerous. She listened, her large eyes steadily focused on a point around my chin. When I finished, all she said was,
"Turn around."
I did, and she started working on the cuts on my chest, arms, and face. Again, cleaning the wounds was a little uncomfortable, but nothing more. I watched her tending me. I couldn't read her expression. She didn't look up in my eyes while she worked, and she kept her manner brisk and steady, very businesslike.
Molly, I said quietly as she finished.
She paused, still not looking up at me.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I had to ask you to help me do what I did. I'm sorry that I didn't make you stay home from Chichen Itza. I never should have exposed you to that. You weren't ready.
No kidding, Molly said quietly. But I wasn't really taking no for an answer at the time either. Neither of us made smart choices that night.
Maybe, but only one of us is the mentor, I said. I'm supposed to be the one who knows what's going on.
Molly shook her head several times, a jerky motion.
Harry, it's over, okay? It's done. It's the past. Let it stay there.
Sure you want that?
I am.
Okay. I picked up a paper towel and dabbed at a few runnels of peroxide bubbling their way down my stomach. Well, now all I need is a clean shirt. Molly pointed at one of the oak doors. In there, there are two dressers and a closet. Nothing fancy, but I'm pretty sure it will all fit you. I blinked several times. What? She snorted and rolled her eyes. Harry, duh, I knew you were alive. That meant you'd be coming back. Leah told me to keep it to myself, so I got a place ready for you. She took a quick step back into the kitchen, opened a drawer, and came back with a small brass key. Here, this will get you past the locks and past the Svartals wards and past my defenses. I took the key, frowning. I'm not asking you to shack up with me, Harry, Molly said, her tone dry. It's just until you get back on your feet, or just as long as you're in town and need a place to stay. Did you think I couldn't take care of it myself? Of course not, Molly said. But, you know, I guess I think that maybe you shouldn't have to. She looked up at me uncertainly. You were there when I needed you. I figured it was my turn now. I blinked my eyes several times and looked away. The kid had gotten this place together, made some kind of alliance with a very suspicious and cautious supernatural nation, furnished a room for me, and picked me up a wardrobe? In just a few weeks? When she'd been living in rags on the street all the time for the better part of a year before that? I'm impressed, Grasshopper, I said. Seriously. This isn't the impressive part, she said. But I don't think we have time to get into that right now, given what you've got going. Let's survive Halloween, I said. And then maybe we can sit and have a nice talk. Molly, you shouldn't have done this for me. Ego much? She asked, the ghost of her old irreverent self lurking in her eyes. I got this place for me, Harry. I lived my whole life in one home. Living on the street wasn't a good place for me to put myself back together. I needed someplace, she frowned. Yours, I suggested. Stable, she said. Quiet, and mine. Not that you aren't welcome here, while you need it. I suppose you didn't get those clothes for my sake either? Maybe I started dating basketball teams, Molly said, her eyes actually sparkling for a moment. You don't know. Sure I do, I said. She started putting the kid away. Think of the clothes as a birthday present. She looked up at me for a second and gave me a hesitant smile. It's really good to see you, Harry. Happy birthday. Thanks, I said. I'd give you a hug, but I'd bleach and bloodstain your clothes at the same time. Rain check, Molly said. Working up the hugs might take a while. She took a deep breath. Harry, I know you've got your hands full already, but there's something you need to know. I frowned. Yeah? Yeah. She rubbed her arms with her hands as though cold. I've kind of been visiting your island. In the middle of the southern reaches of Lake Michigan lies an island that doesn't appear on any charts, maps, or satellite images. It's a nexus point of ley lines of dark energy, and it doesn't like company. It encourages people who come near it to get lost and wander away. Planes fly over the thing all the time, but no one sees it. A few years back, I'd bound myself to the island and the world-class genius loci that watched over it. I'd named it Demon Reach and knew relatively little about it, beyond that it was an ally. When I'd been shot and plunged into the dark waters of Lake Michigan, it had taken Mab and Demon Reach both to preserve my life. I'd woken up from a coma in a cavern beneath the island's surface with plants growing into my freaking veins like some kind of organic IV line. It was a seriously weird kind of place. How did you get there? I asked. In a boat, duh. I gave her a look. You know what I mean. She smiled, the expression a little sad. After you've had someone like the corpse taker pound your mind into pomegranate seeds, a psychic no trespassing sign seems kind of slow pitch.
Huh, I said. Point. But it's a dangerous place, Molly.
And it's getting worse, she said.
I shifted my weight uneasily. Define worse.
Energy is building up there, like steam in a boiler. I know I'm still new at this, but I've talked with Leah about it, and she agrees.
God, she was dragging this out, making me wonder what she knew. I hate that.
Agrees with what?
Molly said, looking down. Harry, I think that within the next few days, the island is going to explode. And I think that when it does, it will take about half the Midwest with it.
Chapter 14. Of course it is, I said. I looked around and grabbed the first aid kit, then started stomping toward the indicated guest bedroom.
I swear, this stupid town. Why does every hideous supernatural thing that happens happen here? I'm gone for a few months and... Ugh! Be right back. Goddamn son of a...
There was a light switch in the bedroom, and it worked. The light bulb stayed on and everything. I scowled up at it suspiciously. Normally, when I'm in a snit like this, light bulbs don't survive eye contact, much less my Yosemite Sam impersonation. Evidently, the Svart Owls had worked out a fix for technological grumpy wizard syndrome. And the room, well, it reminded me of home. My apartment had been tiny. You could have fit it into Molly's main room half a dozen times, easy. My old place was almost the same size as her guest bedroom. She'd furnished it with second-hand furniture, like my place had been. There was a small fireplace, with a couple of easy chairs and a comfortable-looking couch. There were scuffed-up old bookshelves, cheap and sturdy, lining the walls, and they contained what was probably meant to be the beginning of a replacement for my old paperback fiction library. Over toward where my bedroom used to be was a bed, though it was a full rather than a twin. A counter stood where my kitchen counter had been, more or less, and there was a small fridge and what looked like an electric griddle on it. I looked around. It wasn't home, but it was in the right zip code. And it was maybe the single sweetest thing anyone had ever done for me. For just a second, I remembered the scent of my old apartment. Wood smoke and pine cleaner, and a little bit of musty dampness that was inevitable in the basement. And if I squinted my eyes up really tight, I could almost pretend I was there again, that I was home. But they'd burned down my home. I had repaid them for it with interest, but I still felt oddly hollow in my guts when I thought about how I would never see it again. I missed Mister, my cat. I missed my dog. I missed the familiarity of having a place that I knew that was a shelter. I missed my life. I'd been away from home for what felt like a very long time. There was a closet by the bed with a narrow dresser on two sides. It was full of clothes. Nothing fancy, t-shirts, old jeans, some new underwear and socks, still in their plastic packaging, some shorts, some sweatpants, several pairs of used sneakers the size of small canoes, and some hiking boots that were a tolerable fit. I went for the boots. My feet are not for the faint of soul. I ditched the tux, cleaned up, and covered the injuries on my legs, and got dressed in clothes that felt familiar and comfortable for the first time since I'd taken a bullet in the chest. I came out of the bedroom holding the bloodied clothes and glanced at Molly. She pointed a finger at the fire. I nodded my thanks, remembered to take the bejeweled cufflinks out of the pockets of the pants, and tossed what was left into the fire. Blood that had already been soaked up by cloth wouldn't be easy to use against me, even if someone had broken in and taken it somehow, but it's one of those things best not left to chance. Okay, I said, settling down on the arm of a chair. The island. Who else knows about it? Leah, Molly said,
Presumably she told Mab. I assumed word would get to you.
Mab, I said, is apparently the sort of mom who thinks you need to find things out for yourself.
Those are real? I grunted. Have you had any contact with Demon Reach?
The spirit itself?
Molly shook her head. It tolerates my presence, but it isn't anything like cordial or friendly. I think it knows I'm connected to you.
Yeah, I said, I'm sure it does. If it wanted you off the island, you'd be gone. I shook my head several times.
Let me think.
Molly did. She went into the kitchen to the fridge. She came out with a couple of cans of Coca-Cola, popped them both open, and handed me one. We tapped the cans together gently and drank. I closed my eyes and tried to order my thoughts. Molly waited.
Okay, I said. Who else knows?
No one, she said.
You didn't tell the council? Molly grimaced at the mention of the White Council of Wizards.
How would I do that, exactly? Given that according to them, I'm a wanted fugitive, and that no one there would blink twice if I was executed on sight.
Plenty of them would blink twice, I said quietly. Why do you think you're still walking around? Molly frowned and eyed me.
What do you mean?
I mean that Leah's clearly taught you a lot, Molly, and it's obvious that your skills have matured a lot in the past year. But there are people there with decades worth of years like the one you've had, maybe even centuries. If they really wanted you found and dead, you'd be found and dead, period.
Then how come I'm not? Molly asked.
Because there are people on the council who wouldn't like it, I said. Ebenezer can take anyone else on the council on any given day if he gets mad at them. That's probably enough, but Ramirez likes you too. And since he'd be the guy who would, theoretically, be in charge of capturing you, anyone else who did it would be walking all over his turf. He's young, too, but he's earned respect. And most of the young guns in the wardens would probably side with him in an argument. I sighed. Look, the White Council has always been a gigantic mound of assorted jerks, but they're not inhuman.
Except sometimes, Molly said, her voice bitter. Humanity matters, I said.
You're still here, aren't you?
No thanks to them, she said.
If they hadn't shown up at Chichen Itza, none of us would have made it out. Molly frowned at that.
That wasn't the White Council.
True, technically. That had been the Grey Council. But since the Grey Council was mostly made up of members of the White Council working together in secret, it still counted, in my mind, sort of.
Those guys, I said, are what the Council should be, and might be. And when we needed help the most, they were there.
I sipped some more Coke.
I know the world seems dark and ugly sometimes, but there are still good things in it, and good people. And some of them are on the council. They haven't been in contact with you because they can't be, but believe me, they've been shielding you from getting in even more trouble than you've already had.
You assume, she said stubbornly.
I sighed. Kid, you're going to be dealing with the council your whole life, and that could be for 300 or 400 years. I'm not saying you shouldn't get in their faces when they're in the wrong, but you might want to consider the idea that burning your bridges behind you could prove to be a very bad policy a century or two from now. Molly looked like she wanted to disagree with me, but she looked pensive, too. She drank some more of her Coke, frowning.
Damn. Why couldn't I have figured out that particular piece of advice to give to myself when I was her age? It might have made my life a whole lot simpler.
Back to the island, I said. How sure are you about the level of energy involved? She considered her answer.
I was at Chichen Itza, she said. It's all pretty blurry, but I remember a lot of fragments really well. One of the things I remember is the tension that had built up under the main ziggurat. Do you remember?
I did, though it had been pretty far down on my list of priorities at the time.
The Red King had ordered dozens, maybe hundreds of human sacrifices to build up a charge for the spell he was going to use to wipe me and everyone connected to me by blood from the face of the earth. That energy had been humming inside the very stones of the city. Go to a large power station sometime and stand near the capacitors. The air is full of the same kind of silently vibrating potential. I remember, I said.
It's like that. Maybe more. Maybe less. But it's really, really big. It's scaring the animals away.
What time is it? I asked. Molly checked a tall old grandfather clock, ticking steadily away in a corner.
3:15.
10 minutes to the marina, an hour and change to the island and back. Call it an hour for a service call. I shook my head and snorted. If we leave right now, that puts us back here in town right around sunrise, wouldn't you say?
More or less, she agreed.
Mab, I said in the same tone I reserved for curse words.
What?
That's why the lockdown, I said, then clarified. Mab closed the border with Ferry until dawn. Molly was no dummy. I could see the wheels turning as she figured it out.
She's giving you time to deal with it unmolested.
Relatively unmolested, I corrected her. I'm starting to think that Mab mainly helps those who help themselves. Okay. Once Maeve gets to start moving pieces in and out of Ferry in the morning, things are going to get busy, fast. Also, I don't want to be working with the magical equivalent of a reactor core the next time Hook and his band of mini-psychos catch up with me. So. Molly nodded.
So we go to the island first?
We go to the island now. Molly had the apartment building security call us a cab on the theory that it would be slightly less noticeable than the monster car now in the parking lot. They took her orders as if she were some kind of visiting dignitary. Whatever she'd done for the Svartalves, they had taken it very, very seriously. I left Toot sleeping off the fight with some junk food left out where he would find it when he woke up. Bob was in a cloth messenger bag I had slung over one shoulder, still buttoned up tight. Molly glanced at the bag, then at me, but she didn't ask any questions. I felt like wincing. Molly hadn't ever exactly been shy about pushing the boundaries of my authority in our relationship as teacher and apprentice. Her time with my fairy godmother, the Lenanshi, Mab's Girl Friday, was starting to show. Leah had firm and unyielding opinions about boundaries. People who pushed them got turned into dogs, or something dogs ate. The marina was one of several in the city. Lake Michigan provided an ideal venue for all kinds of boating, sailing, and shipping, and there was a nautical community firmly established all around the shores of the Great Lake. I'm not really part of it. I say wall instead of bulkhead, and I'm not quite sure if port is left or if it's something best left until after dinner. I get the terms wrong a lot. I don't care. Marinas are parking lots for boats. Lots of walkways were built on piers or were floating pontoon bridge style in long straight rows. Boats were parked in individual lots, much like in any automobile parking lot. Most of the boats showed signs of being prepared for winter. November can be a dangerous time for pleasure boating on Lake Michigan, and most people pack it in right around Halloween. Windows and hatches were covered, doors closed, and there were very few lights on in the marina. Which was good, because I was breaking and entering again. I'd had a key to the marina's locks at one time, but I'd lost track of it when I got shot, drowned, died, got revived into a coma, haunted my friends for a while, and then woke up in Mab's bed. My life. Hell's bells. Anyway, I didn't have a key or any time to spare, so when I got to the locked gate to the marina, I abused my cool new super strength and forced the chain-link gate open in a low squeal of bending metal. It took me about 3 seconds.
Cool, Molly murmured from behind me. Wait, did you do the car, too?
I grunted, a little out of breath from the effort.
Holy cow, Molly said. You're like Spider-Man strong.
Nah, I panted. Spider-Man can press 10 tons. I can do sets with 400 kilos.
Kilos?
Molly said. I inherited the last guy's weight set, I said. It's this fancy European thing. Not sure how heavy that is in English.
In England, they use kilos, Molly said wryly. But it would also be around 60 or 65 stone.
I stopped and looked at her. She smiled sweetly at me. I sighed and kept on walking out to the boat. It's called the Water Beetle. It could be the stunt double for the boat of the crusty old fisherman in Jaws, except that it had been freshly painted and refinished, and it looked a little too nice. I stopped on the dock in front of it. There. I'd been standing right there, looking out toward the parking lot when it happened. My chest didn't actually feel a pang of agony, but the memory of it was so sharp and clear that I might as well have re-experienced it. It hadn't hurt at the time, not until I'd been in the water for a while, but it had been pure fire once Mab and Demon Reach had succeeded in keeping my soul and body knit together. And to think, I'd had to call in a solid to get the guy to come shoot me. It seemed like kind of a waste at this point. I'd been sure that if I managed to win the day, thanks to my deal with Mab, that I would be a monster in need of a good putting down. I'd scheduled my own assassin, and Molly had used her unique talents to help me forget that it was coming. Once the day had been safely saved, the plan had been to circumvent the evolution of Monster Harry by way of high-powered rifle. Except I'd survived. Next, I guess, came the Monster Harry part. I had it on good authority that it didn't have to end with me going all nutty and villainous. Assuming an archangel was trustworthy, which I didn't, I also had it on good authority that it would end like that anyway. So, at the end of the day, I really didn't know what was going to happen to me in the future. Why should I be any different? The water beetle was definitely not battened down for winter, not yet. She was a sturdy, tough little craft. Not fast, but not afraid of much of anything nature would throw at her, either. Her gangplank was down, and batten and gangplank are about the only boat words I'm comfortable with. I moved up it without hesitation, even in the shadowy dimness of late night on the marina. I was familiar with the boat. I'd visited the island on it on multiple occasions. I went aboard and up onto the roof of the wheelhouse where the driver's position was. I flicked on a couple of tired old bulbs and checked the gauges. Fuel, oil, good. She had more than enough for the trip out to the island and back. The key wasn't in the ignition. It would be in the small safe down in the boat's cabin. But I knew the combination. "We're good," I called softly. "Come on." Molly came up the gangplank while I went down into the cabin. I got no warning whatsoever. No sound, no visible motion, nothing. One second I was going down the stairs, and the next my face and chest were being crushed against the wall, and something extremely sharp was pressing against my neck, just beneath my right ear. Cool, iron-strong fingers were spread over my whole head, pressing it to the wall. The message was clear. If I struggled or made any sound, something pointy would go into my brain. I froze. It seemed smart. If my attacker wanted me dead, I wouldn't still be able to reason that he could already have killed me. "Hello, precious," murmured a man's very soft voice. "I think you're on the wrong boat." I sagged, suddenly in relief. "Stars and stones," I breathed. "Thomas, you scared the hell out of me." The power of the cold fingers against my head did not falter in the slightest, but there was a short, stunned silence. Then the pressure against my skull became furious. "Do you think this is funny?" my half-brother said, his voice becoming louder, fairly boiling with anger. "Do you think I am amused by this kind of prank?" "Thomas," I said, "it's me." "Sure it is," Thomas snarled, the pressure against me surging for a second. "Harry Dresden is dead." I thought my eyeballs were trying to squeeze their way out of their sockets. "Clerk!" "Now," he growled.
I'm going to give you exactly 3 seconds to start telling me the truth, or I swear to God they will never find enough pieces of you to identify the body. He meant it. Hell's bells. He was furious. If I were the kind of guy who ever got scared by anything, ever, which of course I'm not, I would have been feeling extremely nervous at that moment. Mab, I ground out. Damn it, Thomas, you're a lunatic. It was Mab. Mab sent you, Thomas demanded. Mab saved me.